This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. At the bottom of the hour, I will be talking to Elizabeth Millane about her wonderful book called 60 Blades of Grass, about the resistance in Holland. It's a wonderful book, and I'm looking forward to talking to her. But right now, I get to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Wall Street Journal best-selling author, the author of one of my favorite nonfiction books of all time, because it is so beautifully written, The Flight of the Rondon. And I am so happy to welcome you back to the program. Patrick Girondi, how are you?
Thank you very much, Patsy. It's great to be back.
Well, Patrick, as you know, I loved The Flight of the Rondon, which that's the proper way to pronounce it, I think, in Italian.
Yes, it is.
When I read that book, you know, it's nonfiction because it's a story of your wonderful goal for gene therapy and all of the struggles that you have had to go through facing and fighting Big Pharma, who have tried to steal your ideas, have tried to put you out of business. And I think you are such a hero for the work that you've done. And I love that book so much, but when I was reading it, I kept saying to myself as I was reading it, I remember, well, he's such a great writer. He has to write a novel. This is not just an ordinary writer. And so I was so thrilled when I got New City. This is your new book, New City, a story about race baiting and hope on the south side of Chicago. Patrick, you've done a wonderful job with this book.
Thank you.
So, well, in the midst of it, I think you're still fighting Big Pharma. You still have lawsuits going on?
Yes, unfortunately, I'm in the middle of four lawsuits right now. Two in New York, one in Delaware, and one in Massachusetts. I've recently been watching the Netflix Painkiller about the Sackler family, and unfortunately, my situation, it mirrors it in a lot of ways, except if the fraud that Bluebird Bio committed and Third Rock Venture committed, if they're able to get away with it, it could hypothetically cost the American taxpayer and the health providers in our nation over $200 billion. Because there's 100,000 sickle cell disease patients and 2,000 thalassemic patients in the United States. If every single one of those patients were treated by Bluebird Bio's product instead of ours, Bluebird Bio product is $2.8 million per patient. So if hypothetically you took the difference between $2.8 million and $700,000, which is what we always said we'd charge, because it costs me $300,000 to $400,000 to make the product per patient, and then I have to do 15-year follow-up. But if you took $2.1 million and you multiplied it by 102,000 people, it ends up being over $200 billion.
It's outrageous. It's really outrageous. Here, you got into gene therapy because of your son, because of love. And what you're trying to do is keep the price down for the treatment. And it is such an important treatment, not just here in America, but in Africa, where there is so much sickle cell, and that you have to go through this. And as I said, to me, you're a hero. And I'm glad that in between, I know it probably it helps you to be able to write something else. And so you wrote New City.
Yes.
So tell us about this book, which is also very inspiring.
Sure. So I'm a Southsider, born and raised on the south side of Chicago, always around the stockyards. Of course, we know the stockyards started leaving the Chicago in the 70s, and today there's really not much left of them. But at one time, they were the biggest slaughterhouse in the world, you know, taking up a mile by a mile by mile square area. And so next to the stockyards, there was a area that they called New City. And for a while, when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, I lived in New City. And my best buddy, whose name is Davey Polenik, Danny in the book, but Davey is his real name, Davey and I would go shoe shining every Friday, Saturday, Sunday on West 51st Street and West 47th Street. And the area, New City, ended up going from basically, it was mostly Slavic at one time because all of the butchers were coming from Lithuania and Poland and Ukraine, et cetera, in Europe in the 50s and the 40s and the 60s and 70s. And then when the stockyards dried up and work dried up, they left for other areas, and the area around New City became primarily African-American and some Hispanic. But Davey stuck it out. Davey stayed, and he became like, you know, he's Polish, and he became the sage of his neighborhood. And I say in the book he could fix everything from a broken sink to a broken heart. And it pretty much tells his story. And that's what New City is about.
Well, you know, when you're nowadays, of course, when we're talking about big cities in America, just the thought of them, it's so horrific. But for a long time, even before San Francisco fell and New York is falling, Chicago has been a mess. And we've heard year after year of the shootings and the problems, and it's getting worse. It must be heartbreaking for you because you love the city so much. You work there. You were so involved in it.
Yes, it is heartbreaking. I'm a Catholic. When I was 13, 14, I went to a seminary, Franciscan seminary. I lived with 62 brothers and priests. By the way, they were great. There was nothing. I never heard of anything that would resemble any of the pedophile stories that we hear about. And so, you know, I love others because I believe, as Jesus said, we are a brother's keeper. Love others as he loved us, etc. And I really try to live my life that way. And the south side of Chicago is a part of me, and it'll always be a part of me because that's where my roots are, that's where I grew up, etc. And so it is very troubling and trying. One of the interesting things that most people don't realize, however, is that Chicago is not even in the top 25 for violence in the United States per capita. So Chicago, you get about 15, 16 murders per 10,000 people, but you got places like Detroit, St. Louis, Trenton, New Jersey. I mean, some of them are up into the 60s. So as bad as it is in Chicago, there are at least 25 cities that are actually worse.
It's terrible. It's terrible what's happening. So the purpose of the book, I think, to tell your story, to tell the story of in the end of hope. I was very impressed with your New City trailer and Green Castle theme song, which highlights your story. Tell us about that.
Sure. Megan Uecker actually did the trailer, New City. I love it as well. It's no speaking, but it kind of tells the whole story. And Greencastle, you know, the whole idea is that Davey Polenik and his next-door neighbor decided, his next-door neighbor's African-American with five kids, decided that they're going to get away from the city because the area is being gentrified and the city, together with big business, is trying to push all the poor people out. And they do that because, unfortunately, in the ghettos and the inner cities of a lot of our country, you have poor people living in homes that, you know, the taxes are 50% of what the homes are sometimes. It's really bizarre. And, you know, the people can't afford to live there, but they can't afford to leave. And Davey and his buddy dream about going to Greencastle, Indiana, and buying a house for $10,000 that's being left, basically, or being sold by one of Davey's dad's Korean War buddies. And so the whole story is the struggle about them trying to get out before they get basically damaged irreparably by the city, who's got the violation code people after him, who's got the tax people after him, etc. And that's the whole story, basically, and the song Greencastle envelopes that story. I mean, you know, we live in a country where, and I grew up with black people, white people, brown people, yellow people. I mean, it first of all, it's very ridiculous that the United States is still calling people Crayola colors. I mean, it's just bizarre that we're identifying each other as black, white, brown, etc. I mean, I'm Italian. I identify as Italian. I also have an Italian passport, and I live in Italy most of the year. But Italians are Latins. You know, you call Latin America because it was basically invaded by the Portuguese, the Spaniards, and the Latins, which were from Italy, which were from the Rome area, you know. And so it really makes me laugh when people say the Italians are white. If I told an Italian that he or she was white, they'd look at me like I was nuts. But, you know, this whole idea that the United States is this horrible, divided country where the whites are oppressive and the blacks are oppressed or browns are oppressed, it's really a joke. And I can't even believe it any longer that the federal government and the big corporations, including big media, uses Crayola colors to divide, conquer, and bait people into hating each other, which is really ridiculous. I mean, some of the most important people in my life were African American, whether it was the judge, Clarence Bryant, who, when I was 16 years old, sent me away to the military instead of sending me to jail. He saved my life. He died in April 8th, I think, of 2008. And every April 8th, I think about Clarence Bryant. He was a saint for me. Big Mama, who, when I was washing dishes at 15 years old at the Northwestern Hospital kitchen, I was the only light-skinned person out of 40 dark-skinned employees, and one of them really wanted to, you know, beat me up all the time. And Big Mama, off of the soup line or the bread line or the whatever it's called for the conveyor belt where all of the trays pass and you put on Jell-O and meat and broth, etc., she saved me. I mean, and then when I went into the military, Sergeant Smith, you know, a short little black guy, when they wanted to give me a dishonorable discharge because I was misbehaving in the military, Sergeant Smith said, no, I'm not going to stand for it. I'll let you put the kid back. Maybe he does have an attitude problem, but he's a good kid. So all of this idiotic idea that blacks are oppressed and whites are oppressors. I mean, Oprah isn't oppressed. I was in a magazine with Magic Johnson. Actually, I know his brother Larry very well. Magic Johnson's not oppressed. Yet nobody would deny that they are what is considered in the United States as black people. But it's really aggravating me, and it's part of the reason that I was stimulated to write New City, to say this is bullshit. Whites and blacks in America love each other. We have so much in common. We have so many things that we do together. And this idea that the media and the wealthy intellects of the country are pitting us against each other is just absurd. And that's one of the reasons that stimulated me to write many of my remembrances with Davy Polenik and a lot of the things he's going through. I was talking to Davy the other day on the telephone. Davy woke up, he has scabs on his legs, and he found maggots on them. And he called me the other day, and he said, Pat, I've gone to 3 Chicago hospitals. They throw me out all the time. You know, they tell me there's nothing they can do to me. Of course, I don't have insurance. And, you know, of course, I'm a poor guy. You know, what can I do? So, of course, I went in the Internet. I sent him through Amazon, whatever I could send him. I'll be calling him later today. But the fact of the matter is, Davy is what you would consider a white person. He can't afford his health care. He doesn't have water in his house. You know, we got to stop this nonsense. I don't want to go on.
No, it's true. You know, you have faced this with Big Pharma. You see what the struggle is against the system. And it is so sad because I agree completely. I grew up in Detroit and I feel the same way. My best friend was African American, black, and beautiful, and she and I were like we were two against the world because I was from Northern Michigan, blonde, blue-eyed, but because I spoke with a funny accent, Everybody laughed at me because I spoke, you know, sort of a little bit like this, and I sounded a little bit funny to the people in Detroit, and so the two of us were like solid friends against the world, but we were joyful with ourselves and with each other, and we reached out to other people, and eventually we had a wonderful group of kids who we did things, and we were a wonderful amalgamation of Armenians and Catholics and this and that, and it was and this was the joy of growing up in Detroit, that we did have this, we got together. And you're right. I don't understand it. I can't. At this, it's 2023. I mean, this is why they want to do this.
It's money. It's about money. That's how they divide and conquer, and that's it. I mean, and in today, the racial politics, because that's how the politics keep their power. The politicians keep their power. That's how McDonald's. That's how Facebook. That's how all of the big corporations keep their power. You know, divide and conquer, and put all of the population against each other. That's why they won't ask for higher wages. They won't ask for health care and the things that they deserve, because we've got them so busy fighting each other. And in the end, you know, if somebody says that all blacks aren't oppressed, you're a racist. If somebody says that all blacks are oppressed, you're a racist. If somebody says that all whites are oppressors, you're a racist. If somebody says that all whites aren't oppressors, you're a racist.
I mean, they just throw that line
on anyone, whoever it is.
And that's why I think New City, you know, tackles all of this question and shows that people just want a good life. They want this
for them and their family.
Exactly. They want a green castle.
They want to be able to send their kids to go to school, not worrying about them being hurt at school. Want to be able to feed them and have health insurance, or at least health care, so they can take care of them if something happens to them or their parents or themselves or their loved ones. I mean, you know, I always say that the worst song ever written in the history of the world was "The Greatest Love of All" by Whitney Houston. You know, it was the beginning of the end. I mean, I listened to that song and I couldn't believe that they played it at every graduation. They played it at every wedding. The greatest love is not self-love. That's what's called being selfish. That's, we call it in Italian, egoismo. That's the greatest sin. But along with that song, we turned being selfish into being a virtue.
You're right. And in your Green Castle theme song, is that you singing?
Yes, it is me singing. That's me playing the harmonica.
Oh, it's wonderful. I love it, and I wanted to tell people that when they get your book, you have a QR code so people can scan it and they can see the theme song, the video of the theme song, and also it's on your website, right?
Yes. PatrickDurandi.com. The name of the pharmaceutical company is SanRoccoTherapeutics.com. Or San Rocco Therapeutics, and the website is sanroccotherapeutics.com. I just got done with concerts in Italy. We did about 15 of them. Hopefully next year we'll be starting with patients in Italy, gene therapy for thalassemia and sickle cell disease. I will be in the United States beginning around the 10th of September. One of my best buddies' daughters getting married on September 15th, Robin Feldman. So I'll be there for that, and then I'll be visiting with our researchers, University of Tennessee, University of Southern Illinois. I'll be dealing with our attorneys. We'll be looking to raise more money to make sure that the research doesn't stop, and it definitely will not. And I'll be in the United States, and I'll be doing some singing, performing at the Tiny Room in Los Angeles in October, and in a black church, two dates in November, but I don't have the exact dates. So I'll be with my fellow Americans, and I love all of you, and we've got to stop calling each other Crayola colors, you know? It's just silly. We're just Americans, and maybe we're Catholic Americans or Italian Americans or Irish and Polish Americans, but we're not Crayola colors. That's one thing we're not.
Absolutely. Patrick Girondi, I think you're a hero. Your fight for against Big Pharma, against the way that they want to overcharge everybody for everything in this country when instead of trying to make it easier, trying to make it more available, they just want to make profits, and it's fine to make some profits, but not at the expense of so many lives that really are being lost.
You know, and Patsy, the big thing that people don't realize, you know, we talk about capitalism, and, you know, capitalism is great, but of course it needs a socialistic heart. But, you know, you've got these pharmaceutical CEOs, and, by the way, all CEOs in a lot of ways. You know, some of them are carting off $10 million, $20 million a year, and then they say, well, it costs so much for research. Well, let me tell you something. If your CEO is making $10 million, to use a number, and then he has his six or seven C's around him, chief medical officer, chief financial officer, chief operator, all of that. Well, if he's making 10, well, he can't hang on to them. I mean, it's not going to be a happy family unless they're making at least three or four. And then they have their minions around them. And by the time you know it, you've got a small company that has 10 or 15 administrative people, and their bare minimum to get through the year is $20 million without investing a nickel in research. And that's what's going on.
And then, of course, they have to pay their lobbyists who pay off the politicians and who make the all the rules that make it more difficult for somebody like you who really wants to do good for people, really wants to help people, and that you have to struggle and go through this fight. I know I have four patents. I've been through patent fights. They're difficult. They're so difficult. And it takes a lot out of you because you come out with an idea and somebody steals it.
Well, that's right. And Patsy, I don't want to interrupt you, but you hit something and I don't want to forget my train of thought. The corporations use the legal system as their tool, as their arm. I will no longer sign any non-disclosure agreements with big companies because I know all they'll do is you sign it, they steal it, and then they say, sue me. And 6 years later and $2 or $3 million later, you're done. So big pharma, big whoever you want, whatever these huge corporations are, McDonald's or, you know, whoever
I know.
They use the legal system against the little guy because they know the little guy can't afford it. I mean, my company is spending, I don't even want to go into the obscene amounts of money that we're spending, and that is the arm that the big corporations use because they don't care. It's not their money. The CEO, he doesn't lose a nickel. You know, he does all the dastardly deeds. He collects his $5 million, $10 million bonus, and then when he gets in trouble for the crimes that he committed, the corporation pays for his legal bill, and then it takes 5 or 6 years to get through it anyway.
Well, Patrick, I think that New City is a fascinating book. It's an eye-opening book. And, of course, as always, you just write so beautifully. It's a wonderful read. You're a lyrical writer. And I think that comes from being a songwriter yourself, a musician. There's something I find myself, as I'm reading your writing, I find myself sort of in a gentle kind of flow. And I know that it comes from the way that you're writing and that you are a musician. So, Patrick Girondi, thank you so much for being on Joy
thank
on Paper.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
And
I
thank
really
you for the beautiful,
it.
Beautiful dedication you wrote in the book for me. I really love it, and I'm so appreciative. And it's always a joy to talk to you. So whenever you want to come on, just let me know, and I'll have
thank
you back
you
on Joy
much.
On Paper. Okay?
Thank you so much, Patsy. Thank you very much. My best to all of your listeners. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Thank you, Patrick. Bye-bye. Wow. What a story. You know, this guy is amazing, really amazing. He didn't graduate from high school, but he decided to try to save his son's life. And he invented part of gene therapy that nobody else had done. He's really quite an amazing person. Well, we're going to have a book buzz now from Devon Miller, and then a few commercials, and I'll be right back. And I'm so excited to talk to Elizabeth Mullane.
Hey. Hey everyone, it's Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety-Tock Clock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. We're all a little grumpy sometimes, but someone who's especially grumpy stars in the beloved children's book series, Grumpy Monkey. Yes, Grumpy Monkey is back in a spooky new tale called Grumpy Monkey, Don't Be Scared. The book was written by Suzanne Lang and illustrated by Max Lang. Grumpy Monkey Don't Be Scared tells the story of Jim Panzee and his friends braving the dark jungle to collect treats on Halloween. Everything is different in the jungle when it's nighttime, and they all become a little frightened by strange noises and smells. The scariest thing of all for them, however, is returning home without collecting any treats. The sixth book in the Grumpy Monkey series, it's already the number one new release on Amazon for children's ape and monkey books, as well as already making it on the New York Times bestsellers list during the first week of its release. This book is such a delight, and I hope you aren't scared when reading it. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest, Elizabeth Millane, and the name of her book is 60 Blades of Grass, and it is about the resistance in Holland. Hi!
Hello, how are you?
Okay. Do you want me to call you Betsy or Elizabeth?
No, call me Elizabeth so people don't get confused.
Okay, good.
I'm Elizabeth the author.
Elizabeth the author. And it's a beautiful. I love how you have your name in gold on the cover, right there on top of the airplanes. I always stop whenever there's an airplane on the cover because my husband was a pilot, so I like to look at it. So yes, Elizabeth Millane, this is a very a fine book and a wonderful story. I was as an artist myself, I sort of immediately gravitated to your character because I started thinking of myself. What would I do, and how would I do the art that she does? So tell us about your character and about the background here of the story.
Oh, well, thank you so much for this. Really appreciate it. And by the way, the artwork, the cover, was decided on by my publisher and Peter Riva, which was fantastic. I'm glad I didn't muddle it. Anyway, in the office where I write, I have two paintings by Rika hanging up there, and sometimes I wonder if she's saying something with the blades of grass that are there, You had asked me for a little background about this. Did you want to know how I came about finding the information for the book?
Yes.
Okay. My relatives were originally Germans. And after the First World War, they came to Holland. And they wanted very much to establish themselves as Dutchmen and prove to the Dutch that they were aligned with them. My grandmother continued on over to America, where she married my grandfather, Nick. And they had 9 children, 8 of them girls, my mother the youngest. During my junior year abroad, I went to a British university, the University of Lancaster. It was an extraordinary experience. And during the vacations, I made great use of the Ural Pass and all the rails. And I visited my Dutch relatives about 3 times. I had met them originally when they had visited Muskegon, Michigan, where I'm from, and knew them somewhat. But one of the first times I got out of the cab in front of my my great aunt's flat, a woman came running across the street and wrapped me up in her arms and was thanking me and kissing me, and I thought, I'm being mugged. This is an odd way to do it. But apparently my grandmother, knowing how horrible conditions were after the First World War, sent in multiple care packages every week that helped them to survive the end of the war. Anyway, when I was there, they gathered around me and they all spoke amazingly wonderful, clear, fluent English. And they told me their stories, and I was mesmerized by them. When I finally got back to the States, I wrote these stories down because my brothers and sisters, I'm 1 of 6, didn't have that opportunity to hear those stories. And I wanted to get them down because it told me the kind of people we are from. When my uncle thrust out his wrist to me and said, in our blood we are Germans, but in our hearts we are Dutchmen, I thought we should all know what they have done. So anyway, that's where the story came from. I wrote it down. I shared it with them. And then it just percolated in my head.
And how many years was it before you started to write it down? The full.
I started to write it down about 12 years ago. I took writing classes and revised and listened to critiques and then started getting rejections. And I've got to tell you, the rejections are something that taught me so much. It taught me about the market. I'd say 50% of the book is the result of these wonderful rejections that I embraced. So anyway, after a while, I finally got an agent, not an easy feat, and he started sending it out. And again, after every rejection, I took what they said and I incorporated it into the book. And then, gosh, I think it was October, he called to say, we've got a publisher, Bloodhound Books wants it. And it was a wonderful, wonderful day.
Well, of course, Peter Riva is one of the greatest agents in the world, I think. And you're very lucky that you got him. But it also shows that how great you are, because he just doesn't take anybody. And so I know that he saw in you this great opportunity for you to really express yourself and to bring Rika alive, to bring this story alive. And you do learn from rejection. And of course, I love the style that you finally, you know, I'm sure you had her voice at one, you know, in your heart. And to get it down on paper is a challenge. And I like the format. I like her diary entries. I always like books with diary entries. It just makes it so compelling. You really feel the character. So when you finally decided how to do it, what was the flow for you? How did it flow out of you?
The first chapter that I wrote is the last chapter of the book. I was sitting at a writer's group, an editor was speaking, and all of a sudden the voice came to me. I got up from the chair, drove home, and had to get the entire thing down. And I don't think I changed much about that last chapter at all. So that's where the voice came from. And I listened to the voice. And then I had the voice of Maxim. And then I had the voice of Leishan. And the more I paid attention, the more they all spoke to me. And Amy, you know, I thought she was a lovely dimension in the book.
Isn't it exciting when that happens to you, when your characters take over?
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad that you understand that.
Oh, it is. There's something at one point where you feel them so much in your soul. You just know what they're going to say. And it's so exciting. And then when you see this, you see the words on paper, and you know that you've gotten it right and that you're going to touch somebody's heart with your writing. And that's what you do, because this is, it's a complex story about something so horrific. This period in Holland when the Germans took over the country and what they were doing to the Jews. And tell us exactly what Rika's job here was in the beginning, what she was doing. We're not going to give, you know, things away, but I mean, this is important that she was an artist. And who told you about what she did, and how did you translate this into, you know, putting it on paper?
The relatives whom I met with during my junior year abroad when I visited Holland, I probably visited about 3 times. They told me about how she was asked as an artist to go to the rail yards, the bombed out rail yards, because the rail yards were the first place the Germans bombed during the invasion. Then they restored them. And initially, the Dutch did not know where their countrymen were being taken. They knew they were being rounded up. They knew that they were being taken away on trains. But they didn't know where they were going. Obviously, the Germans said relocation. But they thought if they took down all the information about the trains they could, for example, how many train cars, were they cattle or were they passengers? How many people were put on these transports? Was there violence? What direction the train took? If she could paint that in code, pretending to be an artist just painting the weeds in the rail yards, they could keep track of that information and retrieve their countrymen at the end of the war. That was their aim.
So you have, you said you have 2 of her paintings?
I do. I'm not sure if they were painted in that manner, but one has beautiful poppies and lots of leaves, and perhaps the inspiration to name the book 60 Blades of Grass came from that.
Wow. Most people don't understand how really horrific it was in Holland, well, the Netherlands. I still call it Holland. I think, you know, you mentioned that you're from Michigan, and I'm from northern Michigan. And,
oh, wow.
And, of course, every once in a while, when we moved to Detroit, I was raised in Upper Peninsula, but eventually we moved to Detroit, and we would go over to Holland, Michigan. You know, I don't know if you ever made that journey to Holland, Michigan, which was so fantastic for the flowers, because my mother loved tulips, and one of the greatest joys of her life and all of my childhood, the first thing we would do, you know, in northern Michigan, we waited for spring. We'd wait for spring, wait for spring. And my mother and I would always, in the fall, plant tulips. So going to Holland, Michigan for the Tulip Festival was one of the highlights of my childhood.
I'll bet. I've lived not far from Holland. I visited there often. As a matter of fact, my father was responsible for them getting their first windmill from Holland directly.
Oh,
from the Netherlands.
Oh, that's, well, you know how magnificent it is to
it is.
See the Tulip Festival in Holland, Michigan, or in Holland itself.
Yes, yes. It's marvelous.
Now, did you, you know, the country suffered so much during the war. Now, my father was in the Battle of the Bulge, and I followed his footsteps really from D-Day down, you know, through the Ardennes. So I did that area. But I also was in Holland many times and in Amsterdam many times. So how did it feel for you when you were there? Did you walk to some of the battlefields, some of the areas where there was fighting?
No, I did not. I visited with them. I went out to dinner with them. We did go to, and I put this in the back of the book. I won't give it away.
No.
But we did visit a seaside town. But many of them did not want to talk about the war. Maxim, especially, and Rika, especially, did not talk about the war after it was done.
Well,
so they wouldn't have given me a tour of them.
Yeah, no, this is the way it is for so many people. I also traveled a lot to Poland, and so I know how it is. They don't want to talk about it. But there was the Dutch resistance. Most people, people have heard of the French resistance, but there was a Dutch resistance, and they did try to get the word out, not just on, you know, the transportation. They tried to get the word all the way across to America, to wake America up to the tragedy of what was happening in Holland.
Yes. I should note this, because in every talk I've had, people wondered why Holland and why the Netherlands saw so many of their Jews taken to the camps. And I picked up from my research this fact. The government supported the churches. If you wanted to create a church, you would go down to town hall and say, I'm creating this church, and you would be given money to support it. Their taxes supported it. So at town hall, they had all the churches and all the members listed there. When the Germans came in, they took over the town halls, got all the lists of the Jews and their addresses.
Yeah, they did, and it was... It's still hard. You know, it's strange, isn't it? Now we have a war again, a war in Europe, which we didn't think we were going to have another war in Europe, a land war in Europe, a war with tanks and guns and battlefields. And so now people, this generation, can see the horrors of war.
I agree with you. Absolutely. We're repeating so much of what happened, and I'm happy and pleased that the United States and all the allies are rallying to the Ukrainian government and Ukrainian people to fight this evil.
Your book is, you know, as we're reading it and we're learning more about Rika and about her dreams and her hopes for the future. And tell us a little bit more about her family and the man she loved.
You know, I didn't know that. I didn't know who she loved. She did marry, and she was an artist in Paris. But I was told early on while I was developing the book that people wanted to feel closer to Rika. And actually, I'm going to tell you a little funny story right here. I thought, how do I get people to feel closer to Rika and to Maxim and to Lieschen? What should I do? And obviously, inventing a love life is something that's important. So I did. Then I went back to my mother and telling her about the process of the book. And I said, you know, I had to invite sex lives, Mom. Now, my mother's 92, and she threw out her hands and she said, you have to change the names. We still have relatives in Holland. I can't have this out there. So Rika and Maxim and Allie and our Aunt Amy and Lisbeth are all different names for that reason. I wasn't going to upset her with that.
Oh, that's funny. It is funny.
I did hear, though, you know, when I was a kid growing up, I heard the aunts whispering about my Aunt Lisbeth, and how she had promised her mother on her mother's deathbed that she would remain unmarried and available to take care of her sister, Amy. The aunts were very disapproving of that promise, but they were also a little scandalized by her behavior after it. So I lend that into the book. I don't want to spoil it by saying, but...
You know, what is interesting always when you're doing a period book, going back in history, what were some of the most surprising things you discovered in your research? Just about life.
No, I couldn't believe the fortitude of the people who fought in the resistance and endangered their lives every day. I was recounting this to a friend of mine who had actually, his father had resisted the Pakistani government. And he's a silent fellow, but he rose up from the table that we were sitting at and said, "You would, when you're faced with such an evil regime and you see things going on, you just don't have any choice. You have to resist it because your life isn't worth it if you don't." So I thought that was astonishing. Obviously, not everybody did. There were a lot of collaborators, and that was the most worrisome thing. Who could you trust in Holland? At one point, and I was told this from my relative, they said, "Look who's getting fat," because they're collaborating. They're getting food from the Germans. Everybody who's starving isn't working with the Germans.
Wow. Well, I think you've done a beautiful job with this book, telling the story of Rika and of the resistance and of the horrors of war.
Thank you.
Now, of course, I'm now that you're a writer, I'm sure you're writing a new book, or two, or three.
Yes, one book that I'm working on. I help families whose kids had cancer, and the bravery I saw in those children, I needed to tell their stories. But I'm also writing a story about my family and wonderful stories that have come out of my Michigan family, because there are a lot of characters there. I think these stories, I want to put them on paper so people always have them.
Well, that's the right attitude. That's what I try to encourage people to do. Keep the memories alive by writing them down, getting them down, finding that joy on paper, because it's always the first book takes a while. Sometimes it takes 12 years or 20 years. But then once, it's funny, something happens. Once you see your first book and you know, oh boy, I got that on paper, and it's good, and it's touching people's heart, then you know that you can just forge ahead and continue writing, and you certainly discovered the joy on paper. Elizabeth Mullane, I'm so happy that you were on Joy on Paper today. A special thanks, of course, to Peter Riva for telling me about you, and as I said, when I got the book and I saw the airplanes on the cover, I mean, I just grabbed it. I have to. Because actually, my husband and I, we lived in England. We had a small airplane, and we flew. We sort of recreated some of the flights of the RAF because we flew out of an old World War II RAF base, White Waltham in England. And so we recreated with veterans, we would fly over and the bombing runs that they did. So I've flown over Holland many times, and my husband actually jumped out of a plane and did a parachute drop so that he'd know what it felt like. So again, you captured the story beautifully. It's really great, and it's called 60 Blades of Grass. It's very inspiring, and I think people will enjoy reading it and getting out of it the idea that we really have to think about what we're doing, starting wars and having wars. And it's a very touching book. So do you have a website you want people to go to?
Sure, ElizabethMullane.com.
Okay,
Elizabeth. Come and visit me there, And I love the feedback I'm getting from my readers. It's so sustaining.
Well, people, get this book, read it, and then do something nice and put a review on Amazon, because that helps authors. It's such a nice thing to do when you enjoy a book, to put a review, because authors need that, right?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Well,
you're amazing.
It's been a joy, Elizabeth. I think that you're a fantastic writer, and I look forward to your next book. You just have to let me know when it's going to be out so I can get you on my calendar, okay?
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, all right. What a book. I'm, you know, first of all, I just like this, the entire story about an artist who paints in code. Oh, I was thinking, how would I do that? How would I paint in code? And it's really great. It's a wonderful story, and she's done a beautiful job with it. So do get this book. It's available online, and go to her website, and you can find out more about her. But she definitely has found the joy on paper that I am always talking to you about. Now, next week, oh my goodness, this is such exciting news. Bria Burton is going to be a guest host on Tuesday, because she has a very, 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 very special guest. Lou Diamond Phillips is going to be her guest, and she's excited about it. He's going to be with her for the entire hour, and it's really exciting because, of course, everybody, he is, you know, one of America's favorite, really, with La Bamba and all of his movies. He's a fantastic guy, and he decided to write sci-fi, and this tale that he wrote is fascinating, and it is based on a Hans Christian Andersen story. So you will find it a fascinating story, a wonderful interview that I know Bria Burton is so excited about, because she was she didn't give up. You know, she had invited him a while back, but of course he's a busy guy. But sort of thanks to the writer's strike, he's got a little bit of free time, and so he's going to be on Joy on Paper, and we're thrilled because I love his book, I love him, and it's going to be wonderful. So that's on Tuesday. Make sure that you tune in and listen to that interview with Bria Burton. And then, meanwhile, remember what I always tell everyone. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. And you never know. And you won't unless you start writing. So do start writing, like Carol J. Perry, who does 1,000 words a day. Well, she has to, because she's turning out 2 books a year. And she does it. And Witch City Mysteries is now in number 13 is available. You have to get it. And because she's working on 14 already. Anyway, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. I appreciate you. And everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Read a good book. And Ed's going to salute me, because I'm going to salute him, because I should have been a general. Oh, boy, oh, boy. And, you know, I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books about battles. I'm sort of a battle fanatic. So I would have been a great general. Okay, bye-bye, everyone.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
Listen.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Steve Kathan. Hawaii's governor is moving to stop land grabs in the wake of the wildfires designed to block wealthy outsiders from taking advantage of locals who lost everything. Legal challenges are likely. CBS's Lilia Luciano on the agonizing search effort.
Crews have covered less than 40% of the burn zone. Hundreds are still unaccounted for. among them Joe Schilling.
He was texting me that now there are 4 houses burning and then cars exploding on the road.
His friend Corey Blue says Joe was on his way to her home when the fire